Stand by. Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
We welcome Dr. Kristen Joskowski to the show, talking about the many myths and misconceptions surrounding female sexuality. We also delve into the rash of domestic abuse cases that have permeated the National Football League and if the situation will actually change for the better. Director Eric Schwartz joins us to talk about his film Tattoo Nation, where he explores how tattoos went from counterculture to worldwide phenomenon. We speak to Canadian reggae rock band Ill Scarlet about their new CD and hear new music from Taylor Swift, Out of the Woods.
Capture your need for sound.
There's so many myths and misconceptions about female sexuality, and we are looking forward to dispelling some of these myths, not to mention understanding what we are actually teaching young girls about sex and their own sexuality. We're joined by Dr. Kristen Joskowski. She has her PhD in health behavior from Indiana University and now teaches at the University of Arkansas. Kristen's research focuses on sexual communication and consent, desire and pleasure, sexual function, and women's sexuality. Kristen, thank you so much for joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I wanted to start right off the hop by asking you this. Do you think that overall female sexuality is underappreciated and often looked at with disapproving eyes?
I think women are sort of caught in what I would say a double bind. And yes, I guess to answer your question first, yes. But what I mean by the double bind is that women are caught in a position where they are looked at with disapproving eyes if they are sort of too sexy, and what too sexy means is really unclear. So, if women are experiencing sexual activity, you know, wanting sex, looking sexy, sometimes that's seen as really good, right? Because we use sex to sell a lot of products. Mm-hmm. We want to see actresses and models who are sexy. But at the same time, when we have particularly young women or even, you know, adult women who are having too much sex, we tend to describe them negatively, basically.
How are young females taught to understand their sexuality?
Well, and that's another sort of confusing question or tough question, because people in general get information about sex from a number of different sources. And sometimes schools, although that is really variable depending on where you live and the community and the sort of political climate of that, particularly, you know, in the United States, are, you know, is definitely a contentious topic. So whether we get information from schools really depends. Parents, generally, that again varies. If you have a parent who is knowledgeable and comfortable talking about sex, that's great. That doesn't always happen. So where young people mostly get a lot of sex information from is the internet, from their friends, and from maybe older siblings, and all of that information may or may not be accurate, particularly if kids don't know where to look on the internet or come across websites or information that might be completely inaccurate, displaying, you know, messages about sex that are just not realistic. And that becomes really problematic, because then we internalize that, or they, you know, internalize that as the way that it is. Another place that kids tend to turn for information is the media. And so what we see in movies, what we see in music videos, what we see in TV shows, young people tend to emulate that because they're not getting their sex information from another source, like a formalized education in school or from their parents. So they just sort of rely on the media. And I think most people would recognize that how sex happens in movies is not realistic or not accurate to how sex happens in real life.
I would agree. I would agree with that, especially working in top 40 radio. It's interesting to see how everyone sort of maneuvers. And actually, speaking of that in a way, I wanted your take on what virginity means in today's world, because I feel like it's changed even, you know, from 5 years ago, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting question. And you just bring up the top 40. There's a lot of discussion in the last year, 2 years with Miley Cyrus and all those sorts of, you know, issues with, she's had a pure, you know, sort of image, and now she's becoming too sexy. And that's what I was talking about before with this double bind. You know, we want her to be sexy, but then not too sexy. And we want her to be sexy in the right ways. But, you know, your question about virginity is an interesting one because it really goes back to how we define sex. And that really varies. And not just in terms of behaviors. I mean, people could be talking about certain types of sexual behaviors. They might be talking about, vaginal penile sex, or they're talking about oral sex. But then that also varies based on how they interpret the sex. And so there's some interesting research that shows people talk about sex that they might have had penetration, but then they're like, oh, that didn't really count. Or they might not have had penetration and say that did count, that did count, because there's sort of this interesting perception of virginity as some people see virginity as a gift. This is something that I'm giving to someone who I love, and it's something to cherish. And that is often, applied to women. We want to preserve women's virginity as part of our sort of general discourse. Or we might see virginity as a curse. We don't want to get rid of and lose. And we see that a lot applied to men. And you've got movies surrounding this idea of men losing their virginity and trying to get over that hurdle. And so, how we might define sex might be influenced, and thus virginity might be influenced by our motivation. So I have a motivation to say I've lost my virginity, or I have a motivation to maintain my virginity. And a lot of that ties to gender and how we, link our, at least girls, their value to their virginity.
It's funny you brought that up, because I have a huge problem with the way men's sexuality is viewed with regards to their desire as opposed to women's desire. Because I still feel like if you are a woman and you are, like a quote unquote, I don't like to ever use the word normal, but if you are a quote unquote normal, healthy young woman or woman in their 30s or 40s, if you have some sort of penchant to or desires that you want fulfilled as a woman, it's still looked at as quote unquote dirty. But if a guy needs this, that, or something else, it's like, oh, it's just his, his needs, and it's him being a man. Like, I have such a problem with that, and I feel like it's not changing. Am I incorrect in this?
No, I think you're absolutely dead on. We've got a lot of discourse in general language, right? We just say things like he needed, we justify men's sometimes behavior based on their needs, like they can't help themselves. And not only do I think that, so I think this whole perception is unfair to women, because then on the flip side, women are seen as women don't have this need. They don't want sex, or they only have sex to either fulfill their male partner's, desires, or to procreate, or, they don't really want sex. And then if they do, it's sort of like, you should really have sex in a relationship, or you should have sex in a certain way. These are sort of just general, I think broad sort of cultural approaches to sex based on gender. And that certainly is not true. Girls and young women want to have sex. Research shows they want to have sex just as much as men, and they desire sex and have high sex drive. What's also interesting is I think that perception is unfair to men too, because we use this argument to justify men's behaviors. We see that a lot with sexual assault or sexual harassment, where it's like, oh, he just couldn't help himself. And right. I think that that's kind of bogus, because that's just placing men, saying that men, sort of are these drones and they can't help themselves. They just do what they need to do. And that's really, I were a guy, I'd be offended by that I don't have a brain. I can't think, I can't rationalize things. I'm only, one directional. So I think that these views that we have of sex cut across gender and are unfair, because they restrict women from really expressing their sexuality. They're sort of constrained. We don't want to be slutty. Right. And then men, are just sort of painted in this really, I think, unfair way that's really kind of insulting.
You brought up before the sort of the Miley Cyruses of the world, and if I can add into that, like the Rihannas of the world as well. Mm-hmm. And if I can use Rihanna for a second, because I think Miley is trying too hard, to be honest with you. Like, not right now, but, in that initial burst of excitement, I think to switch her career up, I think she got a little carried away. But, like, Rihanna, I think, has always been Rihanna. Like, she was the way she was mm-hmm. in 2005 to the way she is now. So, and in a way, obviously, she's a very successful businesswoman, because she's got her recording career, she's got her, her sponsors and her perfume and, like, everything else. She really is a businesswoman. But I almost feel like when you look at them or her, she's powerful, and obviously you kind of can see, like, her sexual persona in a lot of what she does. And I still feel like she can be looked at as quote unquote dirty. So like, even though she's this mm-hmm. successful female artist, she still, I'm sure, would be referred to on some level as like, you know, oh, she's just dirty and she's like a tramp and like she has to use her boobs and her butt to get where she's going. Whereas like if we look at, you know, Usher, for example, like he's super sexy town and like exudes sexual desire, but he's just an astute businessman, like while being a recording artist. He's not quote unquote dirty.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you are dead on the mark. And I would argue that that probably applies to many more artists than, you know, just Rihanna and even probably Miley Cyrus on some level. I mean, look, we've got a situation where women, to maintain their relevance within media, really need to be sexy. I mean, there's very few women who can get by with a longstanding career without being sexy.
Right.
And I'm not saying that it's bad to be attractive and to be sexy mm-hmm. and to be thought, you know, in a way that, you know, people want to be attractive to other people. But the thing is, like you just said, men can also sort of be both. They can be sexy and they can be powerful and respected for their talent, for lack of a better word. I mean, you know, this is not just about, you know, musical artists, but even in the business world,
right.
You know, you can be an attractive guy, but you can also be powerful and respected. And Rihanna, you know, is talented. I mean, I would argue she's got a great voice and she's talented. She's a talented performer. And like you said, a savvy business person.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, what we continue to talk about is, well, she's sexy and she uses sex to sell her products and uses, you know, uses sex in her videos and, you know, is just trying to be sexy. And some people even argue that, you know, that was part of the reason why she asked for it in terms of domestic abuse. But the thing is, if she wasn't sexy, then she wouldn't be valued. So it's, again, that double bind that I was saying earlier, women find themselves sort of having to walk this tightrope. It's like, be sexy to a point, but not too sexy to the point that we're uncomfortable. And where you cross the line, like you said, Miley Cyrus, maybe she's trying too hard. You know, she might have crossed a line to that point where we're uncomfortable with her sexiness.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying it's good or bad. I mean, you know, I don't really, I'm not a musical critique, but, you know, she is trying to walk this line between being that virginal young Hannah Montana to now being sexy and older. And, you know, at what point do you cross that line? It's just a hard place for women to be, and it's definitely a double bind.
Joining us on the show is Dr. Kristen Juszkowski. She has her PhD in health behavior, is an assistant professor at the University of Arkansas. You can follow her, by the way, with regards to her blogging abilities on kinseyconfidential.org. If we keep along the line of the Miley Cyrus and the Rihanna for a second, I feel like, and I think you touched upon it briefly before, a lot of young girls and even young, you know, young boys, adolescent boys, it seems to be get their cues from celebrities like Miley and Rihanna and obviously others, whether it's on TV, film or whatnot. But again, it's from that sort of pop culture zone. Is this bad if that's where girls and guys are getting their cues from? And if so, how do we turn the tide?
You know, I think it's not. I think there could be better examples. And that's where it gets frustrating when you see people in positions of power not really doing the right thing. And it's not necessarily their fault. I mean, going to Rihanna, for example, she was in a domestic abuse situation with Chris Brown and people were saying and criticizing her for not leaving him and not doing these things. And we look at research, I mean, most women stay in abusive situations for a myriad of reasons. I mean, they're sort of a number of reasons, what manipulation and feeling guilty and ashamed. And these are all things Rihanna has talked about experiencing in subsequent interviews. But when you're a celebrity, you're of course under the microscope. So it makes it really tough. I do think it's hard to, it's bad, I guess, in a sense that we are setting up kids with unrealistic images and not combating that with someone telling them, hey, look, that's not what really happens. Or this is, you know, really how this is negotiated, or this is where we can talk about reality. When you've got a situation, you know, when you're just watching, either it's media like movies and TV shows or music videos and watching relationships unfold, we're only getting a tiny piece of that picture. And when we're in relationships, whether they're, you know, romantic relationships or sexual relationships, we're in reality. And so we're only given a snippet of information to model. And then that's not combated in any way. with actual information. Again, because like I was saying, we don't have good formalized sex education, and most people are pretty uncomfortable talking about sex. I mean, even in my daily life, talking to adults about sexuality, something I'm very comfortable talking about, people really are uncomfortable with just using basic terminology. And so you don't have very good role models in general. And so there's no one to really give young people the facts. Like, here's how it really is. And here's what you're seeing on TV, and sex works great, and no one says anything, and everyone has orgasms, and everyone's happy. And that's not what reality is like. Where you don't see condoms, where you don't see some of these healthy messages, for the most part, in the media. And so, yeah, I think we should be doing a better job maybe giving positive examples, or at least combating that with some type of education about reality.
I have to ask you this with regards to everything that's been going on with the NFL the last couple of weeks. You know, what is your take on these domestic violence situations that have been flaming up? I'm sure there's a lot more cases that we don't even know about, and they'll probably come to light because I know the media is like a dog with a bone right now. It's you know, it's caused this and it's caused this national uproar. Do you think, you know, Kristen, that things will actually change, or is the league just sort of playing lip service so they can keep their sponsors? Because, like, you know, I feel as a woman, I love football. Like, I'm a huge New York Giants fan, even though I live in Montreal, Canada, you know, but I know it's like it's a testosterone-based sport. There's so much around it with regards to that. And it just feels like a lot of the guys get free passes. Do you think that this might be the wake-up call that specific league, and hopefully other leagues, will take a cue from?
I sure hope so. A lot of stuff that I've read and a lot of the stuff I've been following in the media, sports analysts, sort of give me a pessimistic perspective. And here's the thing, not that I'm going to, I certainly don't support or condone in any way, shape, or form what's been happening. And like you said, I do agree, there's probably a lot more domestic violence that we don't know about. And the fact of the matter is, look, I mean, that got caught on tape. And that's the only reason that it really came out, I think. Let's be honest here, that he got suspended, and whether or not, you know, it was seen initially in July or wasn't seen until recently, as has been the story. The only reason it really has caused this uproar is because it was caught on tape and the media went after it like a dog, like you said. And I think that was really good. And I'm glad that it happened, because I don't know that anything would have been done and it would have easily got brushed under the rug, like I think a lot of other things. Because like you said, I think this has been happening, and we've got, you know, hit other cases that have sort of gotten by. The thing is, I think what's a problem with that is when you're allowing these guys to get away with it, you're sending a message to young people that this doesn't matter. And the fact of the matter is, these young guys, these football players who are NFL players, and again, I'm not supporting their behavior, condoning it, but I think it's important to understand that they probably from childhood have never been told no. You know, they were sports stars in high school. They were probably sports stars in college, given all these free passes with school and with grades and with, you know, women, coaches and coaching assistants really trying to help them. And they've always had a support system there for them. And they've always had sort of their entourage telling them that they're great. And then they get to a situation where maybe a partner says, no, I don't want to do this, or, you know, no, you can't treat me this way. And that, and they're not used to being told no. And that's part of our cultural problem. You know, I think it's really important to recognize that we've continued to allow these guys to get free passes. And so the NFL is really in a position, this I meant before, by saying we need people in power to do the right thing. And if they're in a position where they're going to actually reprimand for the right reasons, right? I think, right, my personal opinion is that right now, the reason why they're reprimanding Ray Rice so hard is because he got caught on video. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think if he didn't get caught on video and it wasn't so egregious, no problem. I mean, we could brush this under the rug. It's happened before. I think Ben Roethlisberger is a good example. You know, there was multiple allegations of sexual assault brought against him. There was allegedly a video, and then that video allegedly disappeared. So, you know, he was able to get by. I think that the more the media, like you said, goes after this, the better it would be, because it would bring attention to this. And I think that the NFL needs to set the example because they're let's be honest, so they're a role model for young boys. I mean, being a football star is probably the dream of many young boys, whether it's realistic or not for them. So they need to do the right thing and set the right example. And I'm not sure that they are doing it right now for the right reasons. I think that they're at least reprimanding because they got in trouble, and time will tell whether or not they will take this seriously. And unfortunately, from what I've seen and heard from other sports folks, it seems like a pessimistic, you know, it's really for now we've got caught, and going forward, we'll be a little bit more careful.
I could talk to you
about not getting caught.
Right. Now, I could talk to you for hours, but I know I can't keep you for so long. But I wanted to, before I let you bounce, I wanted to ask you, I guess, a final question for this topic. But I'd love to have you back on the show, so I hope you'll be able to do that with us.
I would love to.
What can parents, Kristen, you know, of young girls do to at least try to ensure that their child leads, you know, a confident, self-assured existence when it comes to their sexuality and just, you know, just being a strong woman in our culture? Because, again, I feel like there's still lots of hard knocks about for the females.
Yeah, I think definitely dispelling any type of negative attitudes. When you hear women talking about, I mean, and this even goes to like body image, things like that, because all that ties into sexuality. When you hear girls picking on other girls, or when you hear women saying things like, he's never going to like me if, you know, if I don't look this way, or I need to look this way for a guy's approval, continuing to pump women's self-esteem that, and I'm not saying, oh, you don't need a guy in your life. I mean, I'm saying, look at, value the things about yourself that are real accomplishments. Getting your education, getting a career that you want, whatever that is. Succeeding in sports, you know, all, in music, in, you know, whatever your passion might be. Really supporting that and giving praise for that, rather than, you know, focusing on things like appearance and proximity to guys. I mean, and that's going to happen in adolescence. I mean, unfortunately, it just does because of the impact of our peers and friends and media. But really continuing to open dialogue. And the fact of the matter is, kids talk to their parents about sexuality. It's the parents who can set the tone in that conversation. So as much as the parents might feel uncomfortable about it, if they can approach their kid and at least pretend to be comfortable, over time, you know, it's kind of like fake it till you can make it. Over time, they'll ultimately become more and more comfortable talking to their kid. And so investigating really good, parents can investigate really good resources to educate themselves, like CKIST, which stands for the Sexuality Education Information Council of the United States. It's at CKIST.org, SIECUS.org. Has a great website and resources for parents to talk and how to talk to their kids. And so parents open dialogue that creates an opportunity that kids know that they can come talk to their parents. I think it's much better if kids are talking to their parents and having sex than if they weren't talking to their parents, because likely they'd still be having sex. So, you know, I think that also recognizing your kid is going to be sexual, is a sexual person, whether or not they actually have sex, I think would be a great first step. And that's really hard for a lot of parents to wrap their minds around, but that would really go a long way.
Kristen, thank you so much for this. We really, really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you. I'd love to, you know, come chat with you again. I really appreciate you inviting me on the show.
Excellent. That is Dr. Kristen Juskowski. Again, she's got her PhD in health behavior and is an assistant professor at the University of Arkansas. You can read her blogs at kinseyconfidential.org.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
From counterculture to worldwide phenomenon, tattoos are now a huge part of our culture. Director Eric Schwartz has documented how ink went from outlaw status to retail store availability in just one generation in his film Tattoo Nation. Eric, thank you for joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show today.
My pleasure.
Eric, why a film on tattoos? What actually drew you to this topic?
Well, what drew me to the topic, Kelly, is that I noticed about 8 years ago, more and more people are getting tattoos. And I'm a photographer, and I'm certainly not bashful. So I would speak to people about their tattoos. And I found it really very, very interesting that what it was people had really thought about these tattoos and were collaborating with artists on them. And I thought, these people were becoming artists in their own right. And it was usually very personal, once again, very thoughtful. And I became intrigued with the whole thing.
What sort of numbers are we talking about now of people actually being adorned with some type of ink? I'm sure you can probably speak, I guess, to the American numbers on that.
There are over 45 million Americans who have one or more tattoos on them.
Wow.
And interestingly enough, it has just happened where more women are tattooed than men.
Oh, my goodness. I would have never thought that.
I know. I was surprised myself.
Would you say, Eric, that America is the leader in quote-unquote being tattooed?
No, I don't think per capita it is. It may be in sheer numbers, but not per capita. It's very big in Europe. Germany, England is surprisingly a large number of people are tattooed. And it's actually catching on in China, if you can imagine that.
Wow, yeah, that is something I wouldn't have thought they would have, I don't know how to put this, but like allowed, if you will.
Exactly, yeah.
Can you explain, Eric, how tattoos actually got their start and how, I guess, getting a tattoo or being tattooed started to spread?
Sure. Tattoo, it may be one of the oldest art forms of mankind. They found mummies 4,000 years old with tattoos on them. They were, you know, maybe lettering or a simple symbol, nothing like what you see today. Then it was in Polynesia, and the sailors, I think it was Cook's expedition, they discovered tattoos and brought them back to England. Really, there are a lot of indigenous cultures that were getting tattooed. We just didn't really know about it. And in Europe, it's kind of funny. It was actually 75% of all royalty in Europe had tattoos. It used to be very expensive, and for a very select few, kings and queens had it. Winston Churchill's had it, had a tattoo. And it really is a very bizarre history. It's just really nothing like what we thought. But in terms of what Tattoo Nation talks about, it's really the American contribution to the tattoo art form. And it's very much like the blues, Kelly. It's you know, the blues, as I'm sure you know, came from the Mississippi Delta.
Mm-hmm.
And then that whole thing spread. Well, this new illustrative, you know, virtually photorealistic tattoo came from the Chicano community. And it started in the Texas prisons, and then it went up to Los Angeles, and in the Los Angeles prisons and barrios, and then spread across the not just this country, but the whole world.
In your, I guess, research, Eric, if you will, have you noticed, is it more Caucasians that are doing the tattoos, or is it really spread across the board with Hispanics and African-Americans, for example?
Yeah, if you look at the basketball players and football players and stuff, yeah, it's not uncommon for African-Americans to get tattoos. I think there was something for a long time where it was mainly Caucasians and, you know, Oriental, lighter-skinned people that got them. But I think right now it's across the board.
Joining us on the show is Eric Schwartz, director of the film Tattoo Nation. Make sure to check out their website, tattoonation.com. Eric, with regards to your film, what do you want people to take away from it? And what do you say to people who, you know, have the notion of like, oh, tattooing, badass, like, I don't want to know about it?
Well, I'll tell you, Kelly, I've had parents come up to me after showings that said, thank you for making this movie because I now understand what my son or daughter, what they've been doing, and understand that it's actually an art form of self-expression. It may not be for you or I, but to these people, by and large, they are very sincere about it. It's something that really, really means something to them.
I actually wanted to go further with that thought, Eric, just for example, with the teenagers, the one, because it just seems like almost, you know, all, not every teenager, but it seems like a lot of teenagers are sort of just waiting for their 18th birthday to go and get inked. Does that concern you at all? Just because, again, I love tattoos. I think they're amazing. I don't have any, But I think, you know, like you said, some of them are very well thought out, and it's you know, a specific meaning for the person and all that sort of stuff. But my concern, and I've actually talked about this on one of the radio stations that I work for, we did a topic about it with regards to younger adults doing it, you know, getting whatever it is, and maybe even getting several of them and then regretting it by the time they're 30. Like, do you think kids should be at least 21 before they get inked?
You know, that's a very good question. Looking back at it now, you know, should I have made that type of decision when I was 18? Probably not. And I don't think it'd be the worst idea to make it 21. I really don't. I just think that this is something they should discuss with their parents and really understand what they are doing. Because getting tattoos removed is very painful and very expensive. And there are certain colors like turquoise that don't come out. So it's, you know, a lot of people just think, oh, I'll just get it lasered off. Ho-ho, not at all. It's not something you want to do. So I think you just, like anything else, Kelly, real thought has to be put into it.
Yeah, it's funny that you actually brought up about the tattoo removal, because I remember, I think it was a couple of years ago now, Mark Wahlberg, who, as we all know, used to be, you know, rapper mm-hmm. Marky Mark, he went through several years, it sounded like, of trying to get tattoos removed from when he was a kid. It sounded like he wanted them off because of his children and that he wasn't proud of what he had done. So again, like I, even in that show I had talked to you about, we mentioned that, you know, that if Marky Mark, as cool as he is, realized mm-hmm. that it was, you know, something that he didn't want anymore, that people really should be aware of that. And even, for example, you know, I have a huge problem with Justin Bieber because he's so influential on so many people and he's not even 21 yet. And I think he's got like over 20 tattoos. And again, some of them I question, like now I'm sure they mean something to him. And some of them, you know, do look great. But I worry about that, you know, owl on his ankle or his back of his calf. Like in 30 years, is he really going to want that there? And it just seems like there's so many kids that would be looking up to him.
I think that if it's a tattoo that really comes from the heart, they won't regret it. But if it's just something they're doing to be cool, more than likely they will.
Okay. Now, I wanted to ask you about the rise or the popularity, if you will, of people watching tattoo shows like Bad Ink or, mm-hmm. you know, Miami Ink, Los Angeles Ink, or whatever it was called. Obviously, a lot of people that are watching those shows are probably not people that are tattooed even.
That's true. That's very true. I just think the process is interesting, and even though a lot of the tattoo artists don't like those shows for some reason, because, frankly, they aren't really reality shows, they're very scripted and all that, it does show the process, and it does show the talent of these amazing artists, and it does show, you know, what type of people, that these are, like, middle-class people, you know, everyday people who want to express themselves that way. So I think that the tattoos shows have been helpful in that way.
What do you want people to take away from your film, Eric?
That it's an art form, that it really truly is an art form. And I want to also give credit to the Chicano people who came up with these amazing ways of doing the lining and the shading and gave everyone the Rosetta Stone to illustrate the ideas that they may have.
Before I let you go, Eric, do you think that the popularity of getting inked is going to decrease or wane, or do you think this is just the beginning of its rise and continued popularity?
I think it will be that people will be very, very selective about what they get tattooed on them, but I think it will continue. Do I think it will be as extreme as it is now? No.
Okay.
I think you're not going to see facial tattoos and stuff, but I think people who either want a picture of their child on them or their wife or something that means something to them. Yeah, I don't think you'll find your friend having a tattoo anything to be shocked about.
Eric, thank you so much for your time today and all the best with the film.
Thank you, Kelly.
That's Eric Schwartz, director of the film Tattoo Nation. Check it out, tattoonation.com.
KellyAlexanderShow.com.
We're happy to welcome to the show a Canadian reggae rock band, Ill Scarlet, that's been doing its thing for over a decade now, touring all over the place and becoming solid musicians while at it. We're joined by band co-founder and lead singer Alex Norman, talking about their latest CD, Ill Scarlet, featuring the single Down For Whatever. Alex, thanks for joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So, Alex, you have to tell us how the band actually came together and how you decided on the name Ill Scarlet, because we have people actually listening right now from overseas. So if they haven't heard about you guys yet, I want them to know where it all started.
Oh, okay. Well, it started out 12 years ago, and Swadek, the drummer, and I were friends in high school. We played in bands through high school, and then after we finished high school with lack of any post-secondary educational ambition, we decided to start a band instead and kept playing. And basically, we just started playing reggae rock because we were really, really into Sublime at the time, and named ourselves Ill Scarlet because, well, we didn't have a better name to call ourselves at the time.
What does it feel like knowing that you guys have been together for, you know, over a decade now and are still at it?
I mean, it's cool. You know, he's been my best friend since high school. So it's nice to have friends for that long and be able to work with your friends. We've got to do some really cool things and see some really cool places. And, you know, there are still lots of places and things we have to do. But, you know, we are happy with what we have done. But we are excited to continue making music and exploring new, you know, opportunities.
What do you actually consider to be your first big break in the music industry?
Well, I guess the big break would either be when in 2004 we showed up outside the Vans Warped Tour in Toronto, and we just started playing for the lineup. And Kevin Lyman, who runs the Warped Tour, he came and saw us playing, so he invited us backstage for the night, and we became the barbecue band for that day. So while all the bands are finished their sets and kicking back with barbecue and beers and stuff, we were the band that got to play. And from that, we got on the the Canadian dates for the Warped Tour the next year. And then finally in 2010, we did the entire thing. So that was a big story that went around, and it was super exciting. And then I guess the next time would be when we got our song Heaters, and our first single was put on the Edge in Toronto, I think 2005, I think. And, you know, we were totally independent. We recorded ourselves and it got on the radio, and then eventually it went up into heavy rotation. And then, you know, the label started coming to talk to us. And that's when, I guess, things really started rolling.
Alex, do you still get a kick, you know, out of hearing your songs on the radio, especially like the first time you hear that new single?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's just exciting when, you know, you put so much work into something and then other people can recognize its value. And, you know, when people tell you like, oh, I heard your song on the radio, and, you know, just have my mom hear my song on the radio, that's probably the most exciting, because, you know, there's nothing better than making your mom happy.
That is very, very true. Your new CD is self-titled. Why did you go back to that? Because obviously you've had other, you know, sort of CD names, if you will, or CD titles. Why did you go back to your roots, if I can put it that way? And what kind of message are you trying to send to fans and new fans with this latest disc?
Well, I guess we named it Ill Scarlet because, like I said, we've been making records for a long time. And this record we worked with a producer named David Kahn. He's out of New York. If you look him up, he's amazing with stuff he's done, including Sublime and like Strokes and Paul McCartney. But he's someone we've always wanted to work with, and we finally did get to work with him after years and years of trying. So, you know, we feel that, you know, the way the songs are, the types of songs that are on this record, and how they were written and how we produced them, was really something we've always were trying to do, and now we finally were able to do what we wanted to do. So I guess that's why we felt it would be appropriate to name it Ill Scarlet and be this, I guess, our defining, you know, record, at least in our eyes. And I guess the messages we're trying to send with this record is just, it's always been the same. It's always just believe in yourself and do your own thing. And, you know, that's really sort of, I guess, all that is the message that's been all the Ill Scarlet records. But, you know, we've worked for so long, and, you know, we've had some success. You know, we've made some mistakes. Hopefully we made the right mistakes here and there. But, yeah, we're still going at it, and we still love making music, and we still love touring. So, you know, there's no sign of us slowing down anytime soon.
Hanging out with us on the show is Alex Norman, lead singer of Canadian reggae rockers Ill Scarlet. Follow them on their website, illscarlet.com. Alex, your song Down For Whatever, what speaks to you about this track, and why release it as a single?
Well, this song we wrote in the earlier part of this year. We wrote it in, we had just finished a tour with the Mad Daddies of the Western United States and even Canada. And there were a couple guys who had provided some rhythm and music stuff for another song on the record called Raindrops. So we never met them, so we thought we'd meet with them, and we met them and just started, you know, listening to different, you know, songs and stuff, and there was one beat or whatever they had going that we sort of liked, so then we started just putting words to it, and, you know, by the end of the day, we had 75% of, you know, Down for Whatever written, and then the next day, we just sort of finished it off, and it was just one of those songs that was really easy to write. It just felt very natural. You know, some songs take forever to write, and you just kind of, they're rewriting lyrics and all that, but this one was just easy. It was just a fun summer song about, you know, whether it's your girlfriend or your boyfriend or just your friend, you know, you can always count on you know, your friends to be there for you, and, you know, you're always down for whatever when it comes to your friends, you know, whatever you want to do, I'm down. So it's just a fun song that it's really fun to play and sing, and it was a great time to write.
Now, you guys not only tour in Canada, but you have following in the U.S. What goals have you set for yourself stateside, and do you have plans to migrate overseas as well?
Well, we'd love to have a record, you know, properly for sale in the States. I mean, it's always hard for our American fans to get a hold of our music, even this one. It's out on iTunes in Canada, but not in the States. So we'd really like to solidify a relationship with a label or distributor down there that, you know, people can have the music available to them. We'd love to continue touring Canada as well as the States. And pretty much wherever people want to hear us, we'll go. I mean, in the past, we've gone to China, we've gone to Japan, going to Europe. We'd love to go back to all those places, as well as Australia would be really cool. And, you know, I mean, the world's so interesting any place you go to. So if there's a place out there that wants to have us play, I mean, we'll go because you know, travel broadens the mind, right?
That's amazing. I wanted to ask you, you know, again, being in the band for so long now, over 10 years, what's the biggest lesson that you've learned by being in this band and the fact that you guys have held strong?
Oh, the biggest lesson, I guess, you know, the work's never done. Even when you think that you've finished, you know, after you've finished a big tour and, you know, you're exhausted, you know, you take a couple of days, but then it's right back to figuring out the next tour or getting songs together for your next record. And, you know, you always have to keep trying to keep people interested, whether it's with social media, you know, on the YouTube or, you know, new music. I mean, nowadays, you know, people want music, new song almost every day. So you have to always keep focusing on it. It's a lot of fun, but, you know, it's a lot of work, but, you know, it's great work. It's super exciting when you get to go to a place that you've never been to before, and there's people out there who know you and want to hear your song. So, you know, as much as it's a pain in the ass to fly 14 hours, whatever, to Japan or whatever, when you get there and there's people who already know who you are, you know, that's a pretty amazing feeling that I can't even really describe, nor can I compare to any other feeling. But, you know, it's nice to be able to turn just some melodies and song ideas in your head into a record and then have other people know the music and appreciate it, even though you don't know them. So I guess just working hard is the lesson I've learned, that you always have to keep working hard and keep working harder. But that probably rings true for any sort of business, I would imagine.
Alex, do you find the Canadian music industry to be in good shape? And what improvements do you wish would happen, or do you see where we could be stronger?
Well, I mean, yeah, the Canadian industry, I mean, it's changing so much, and I don't really follow it like I think most people would expect I follow it. As far as like the industry people and the business goes, I don't care. It has nothing to do with me. I mean, it sounds silly, but I have a manager who deals with that because I'm really not interested in the industry. I'm interested in the music, and I'm interested in playing live and the fans. And, you know, that's my job, is to hang out with people and make music, and that's what I really love to do. The industry, it is really great for Canadians. I know we've gotten a lot of help from Factor and SoCan, you know, to help get our songs on the radio and help even fund some of our touring outside of Canada. But I think just like any music industry in the world, nobody knows what's going to happen, because it's the internet and, you know, downloading and social media, it's anyone's game, and I don't know what's going to happen, but it changes every day, so I can't really say much about that.
What's the biggest piece of advice that you would give to any young band that's sort of starting up now, just, you know, trying to do what you guys have accomplished? What, you know, after all these years of knowledge that you've picked up, what would you say to them?
Well, I guess you have to work hard and really focus on, you know, any tools and all tools that you have at your disposal, whether it's social media, You gotta write songs, that's usually helpful. Touring hard and really dedicating yourself to your craft, so, you know, working every day on writing songs, or even if it's, you know, sorting out tours and figuring that out. I mean, the hardest part is getting a van and getting a tour and just, you know, getting to all these places. And I mean, you learn as you go, as you go along, as we have. Like one specific thing that you can do when you're touring outside of like your hometown, where you may already have a following, if you're touring somewhere else, like an hour or two away in a different city, what we used to do is we used to rent school buses for, you know, people who wanted to come see us play from our hometown, so that we would actually bus them to the show and then bus them back at the show. And that's good for a lot of reasons, because first of all, you're going to bring your own audience, so you're not going to be playing for nobody, as well as the promoter will see that you have all these people here who want to come see you play, so they may offer you, you know, bigger and better shows, opening up for larger bands when they come through, and then that exposes you to more people. And as well, I mean, if you market it like the party bus or whatever, then, you know, people usually drink and do whatever and get all silly that way. But because you provided transportation, you're not going to have anyone, you know, drunk driving. And, you know, I mean, last thing you do want is people to get hurt at your shows or going to and from your shows. So that's so you make sure everyone gets there safe and home, gets home and there and home safely, and they can be the biggest idiot they want to be, because, you know, they'll be safe.
Awesome. Alex, I think that's a great idea. And thank you so much for spending time with us on the show. We really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. No problem. Thank you.
That's Alex Norman, lead singer of Canadian reggae rockers Ill Scarlet. Again, follow them on their website, all their social media there as well, illscarlet.com.
Hey, this is Alex from Ill Scarlet, and you're hanging out on the Kelly Alexander Show.
Such a lovely melody is running through my head. Let me play it for you.
It wasn't long ago when I didn't have nothing. Shows every day, all I had was a road. Then I met you and my heart started humming. Heard the van call, but I didn't want to go. 7 years later and I'm still entertained, cause it's what I do and it's all that I know. Looking in my pocket and I still got nothing more. With you in my life, I don't need anymore. No matter how far I go, I'm never far away.
You cannot f*** with this.
And through the hard times, every night felt bright, so I guess that we made it. I want you to know, while the future's still unknown, to you, I never will let go. No matter how far I go, I'm never far away. Yeah.
working overtime that Taylor Swift's new single, Out of the Woods, is actually a song about One Direction's Harry Styles. Now, as we all know, Taylor likes to express her pent-up emotions over her past loves, and this seems no different. Some of the lyrics seem pretty specific that it is chronicling her time with Harry back in December of 2012. Now, Taylor, of course, will not really cough up who she's talking about. All she'll say is that this was about a past relationship that she was in where she didn't know from day to day if it was going to last or self-combust. Out of the Woods is actually the second single off her upcoming new album, 1989, which drops on October 27th. And you can hear for yourself if you think this song is about Harry Styles or not. This is Taylor Swift, Out of the Woods, on The Kelly Alexander Show. On the show this week. We always appreciate your time. A big thank you going out to Dr. Kristen Joskowski, Eric Schwartz, and Ill Scarlett. Here is your inspirational quote of the week, this time coming from Robert H. Schuller. High achievers spot rich opportunities swiftly, make big decisions quickly, and move into action immediately. Follow these principles and you can make your dreams come true. Make sure to follow us on all of our social media on Twitter at K Alexander Show, on Facebook, Kelly Alexander Show, and of course our YouTube channel where we feature our interviews, youtube.com/Kelly Alexander Show. Any comments or questions? Kelly at KellyAlexanderShow.com. Have an awesome week. You and I'll chat soon.